This podcast contains explicit content and is not suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to Always the Last to Know. I'm Ash.
I'm Katie.
What's up, Katie?
My pipes burst. Oh, that's not even really just, that's not even all of it.
I don't even fully know what's happened.
Everything is wrong with my 124-year-old pipes. Yeah, I was like, I'm really stressed out, guys. If you couldn't tell by the name of this episode, it's not a Diana episode.
Yes, it is definitely not a Diana episode. Also, if you're on TikTok, please go watch literally all of Katie's videos from start to finish as many times as you want. Put that shit on in the background while you do things and just let it play so that Katie can have more money to help pay back this loan for fixing the plumbing.
Yes. Speaking of money, I'm not sure if it's listeners or followers. Some of y'all were very determined to send me some money on Venmo for my plumbing. So I want to say thank you. I did donate that to Operation Olive Branch. Please don't send me your money. I was able to get a loan, and like, I'm probably going to make a video on TikTok about this, but like, people are kind of giving me shit for like not taking the help or whatever. Like, I have a lot of help in my life and I have a lot of privilege in my life, including the privilege to like stress now. There are people dealing with like life or death issues where like your $5 is going to save their life. Mm-hmm. So it's so sweet. I think it's so cute that you guys were like determined to get me that money. I think it was a total of $25. From various people, but like, please just donate that. If you want to donate it in my name, like, by all means, please don't send me your money.
While we're on that topic of donating money to people who desperately need it, we are waiting to hear back from Pass the Hat to be connected with the GoFundMe for a family in Gaza. Just know we're waiting on that, but like, we're always posting, especially on our personal Instagrams. I'll try to be better about that on the podcast Instagram, but like, always posting links to places where you can donate money. We would rather you donate it to people who are dying than us. But if you watch Katie's TikToks multiple times, that does help get some kind of money to Katie. But we'd rather you give your actual dollars to other people who need it.
Yes. TikTok generated $16.1 billion of revenue in 2023 alone. So just watch my TikToks. They can help us pay for this plumbing.
Yes.
And you guys, if send your dollars to whatever humanitarian aid and crisis that is like near and dear to your heart.
Yeah.
And if you can't think of one, I've listed a bunch on TikTok. Ashley has a bunch in the show notes. Like, I'm a pretty privileged person, so please don't give me your money. Please don't. Thank you. That's all. I feels weird to say that, but like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I really don't need you guys to do that. You're very sweet, though.
We appreciate you. Moving right along. So Katie and I are back to recording in two different places because your girl had a whole ass panic attack last week. I freaked the fuck out about my life. The pneumonia probably didn't help.
Probably not.
But I freaked out because I missed New Jersey and I missed working at the funeral home and I missed the community that I had here. As much as I absolutely love Katie, the time that I got at Katie's helped me realize that I didn't actually want to leave New Jersey. I just needed to get out of the apartment that I was in with my soon-to-be ex-husband. Katie helped talk me down out of my panic and literally was like, hey, call your fucking mom. Because she's gonna let you come home. And that's what I did. I packed up as much as I could fit in the Subaru the next day. And I came home to New Jersey. And I have my job back at the funeral home. Though it's a longer commute now, I'm safe. My soul feels good. I feel so good being back at work. It's nice to be with my parents. But that's where we're at. So I apologize. Truly, it was literally all my fault that there was no episode last week because I could not handle that shit.
As someone who loves to bolt, pack your shit up and run away. I've been telling Ashley to pack her shit up and run away since whenever this first started, and that applies to every situation, no matter where you are. If you're like, I need to get out of here, pack your shit up and run away.
Yeah.
Fuck whatever responsibilities you have. Pack your shit up and go home. Like, I'm all about it. I'm all about the Irish exit, no matter where the fuck you are.
And it's so funny, like, I've had multiple people text me and be like, are you and Katie okay? I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Of course we're okay. They're getting their master's in clinical psychology. They talked me down from my one of the worst panic attacks I think I've ever actually had in my life.
Probably.
And honestly, when you texted me and you were like, dude, I'm so autistic, I'm so happy to have my space back, I was like, yes. Good for you.
No fucking problems here. Dude, I packed your closet so fast with those trash bags. Can we just talk about that fucking brilliance? And how easy was that to unpack?
It was amazing. And my dad, like, helped me carry them in. I was like, I went, isn't Katie so smart for doing this? And he was like, yeah, this is really smart.
Yeah, dude, that's because I am team pack up your shit and run away.
Taylor wrote the bolter for you.
For me. You don't learn that kind. I literally like packed up Ashley's closet in genuinely maybe 2 minutes.
It was impressive, honestly.
I'll make a video about how I did it. Pack your shit up, go away. No, Ashley and I are fine. Always, always, always. Y'all would know it first because we would probably just tape a therapy session between us and put it up on Patreon.
Yeah. So sorry I didn't do the usual, like, oh my god, there's not going to be any episode this week. But truly, I didn't even have the emotional capacity to do that. And I was like, I feel like everybody understands that shit is weird for me right now. So if we're missing an episode for a week, y'all will get it.
Shit's weird. Well, and then my pipes exploded. Oh, so yeah. Then that information went up and everyone was like, oh, yeah. Oh, you know what? And Ashley, I haven't told Ashley this, and listeners, I feel like I just need to prepare y'all. Goose is slowing down a bit.
Oh no. Is that why she's been like weirdly barking a lot more than usual?
So she was weirdly barking a bunch, and now she's just been wildly quiet.
Oh, that's not. Oh, that's uncomfortably abnormal.
Yeah. And like when I go to like put her, when I get the food out of the fridge, she doesn't come running. Goose is slowing down a little bit. So just a heads up, it might be coming soon, everyone. I'm okay. Remember, I took her home for hospice, so I've been emotionally.
You were like, you guys said 6 months. Why is she still alive?
In 3 months, it'll be 3 years.
Oh my god.
So, but yeah, I noticed it last night and I was like, oh, interesting. Okay. Aww. Like, she let me cut her hair on her face, like, with very little issue. And I was like, oh, shit.
Oh, that's not normal.
That's not good.
Oh, goosey. Goosey girl.
Goosey girl, she's an old lady.
Yeah.
An old lady baby. So, heads up on that all. I don't want it to come out of the blue.
Ugh. So much. So much happening. So much happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. School starts in 3 days.
Oh, yeah, that too. Oh my god. All right. Well, you know what?
Cheers. Lights, camera, bitch, smile.
Fake it till you make it, and I did. Okay, so this is actually going to be a pretty long fucking episode, so now that we got that update out of the way, let's get into it. Also, I apologize for my voice. It will crack throughout this. I am still dealing with the tail end of the pneumonia, so yay.
The pneumones.
Over the last several weeks, we have been witnessing a major wave of college and university students taking to their campuses to peacefully protest the ongoing genocide of the Palestinian people and to persuade their schools to divest from financially supporting weapons manufacturers and the far-right government of Israel through school endowments. These encampments and peaceful protests have been met with contention by school leadership, the threats of suspensions and expulsions, and violence from the police and counter-protesters. In reading through comment sections online of a lot of the videos that we're seeing and sharing, I have noticed a lot of people bringing up the similarities of these instances that we're seeing now to other student protests against war, genocide, apartheid, specifically referencing the violence of the Kent State massacre.
Definitely.
In response to the mention of Kent State, I also noticed that like a shocking amount of people, or at least shocking to me, had no idea what people were talking about. And they were like, what's the Kent State massacre? What's that? Personally, I think that discussing these protests and learning about these pivotal moments is what can help us to better understand the thought process behind a lot of student liberation movements throughout history and teach us ways to better advocate for ourselves and others. So today, we're going to talk about what exactly took place at Kent State University in 1970.
Are we going to also potentially discuss why, of all college massacres, this one is not as well known as some of the other ones? Like, this is one of those things that's like purposefully not taught.
We will be getting into the aftermath and some of the legal cases as far as civil and federal, and I think that that might help shed some light on why people don't talk about it so much.
Okay, word.
Yeah. Before we discuss the events that actually took place on campus, we need to talk about why there were student protests happening across the nation at that time. This was all during the Vietnam War, which had truly been one of the first wars that was like really broadcast right into people's homes on their TVs. So the visibility of this war, among other things, was one of the major reasons why there were so many people protesting the war itself. There were also protests against the military draft. From Students in the Anti-War Movement, written by Kenneth J. Heineman for the Bill of Rights Institute, quote, "Democratic President Lyndon B. Johnson's escalation of the Vietnam War in 1965 gave SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, a cause of its own, as well as a recruiting boost. SDS leaders opposed the war because they felt it was unjust and feared being drafted. As the war continued to escalate, so did the militancy of anti-war students," end quote. The protests themselves had begun to slow down because Richard Nixon had made campaign promises in 1968 to end the war when he was elected president. That was until he decided to invade Cambodia. And after that decision, student protests across the country began to ramp up again. That was a very, very short, small summary of what the fuck was happening in our country at that time. Please, I am not the biggest, like, war buff. I'm not really, like, I know Katie usually does these historical deep dives, and I'm much more, like, current events. But seeing current events happen right now, we had to talk about this. So I implore you to go look up more about, like, what was happening in the country as far as protesting the Vietnam War, the way that our people were reacting to student protests, the way that people were reacting to the war itself. Like, you should definitely look more into that, because this is not that. Now that we have a bit of an understanding of why there were student protests across the country, let's dive into the events surrounding the massacre at Kent State University. From Britannica, quote, "At Kent State, on Friday, May 1st, 1970, two rallies were held at the Commons, a grassy open area at the center of campus. The Commons formed a kind of natural amphitheater that was bordered on the north and south by walkways, on the northwest by the Student Union, a heating plant, and the ROTC building, on the east by Blanket Hill, a partially wooded slope that climbed to Taylor Hall, and on the southwest by dormitories. The first rally was held at the base of Blanket Hill near the Victory Bell, which was a bronze locomotive, or is a bronze locomotive bell in brick and sandstone housing that was traditionally rung to celebrate sports victories," end quote. I thought it was important to set the scene of what the campus looked like and where the protests were taking place, because it'll be easier to see in your mind how the National Guard eventually kettled the protesters on May 4th, 1970.
Can we find a bird's eye image for the gram?
Yes, I can absolutely, sweet, absolutely get a map of that. At the first rally on Friday, May 1st, that was attended by a crowd of around 500 protesters, a group of graduate students buried a copy of the U.S. Constitution to symbolize how they felt that it had been desecrated by Richard Nixon and the decisions he was making regarding the Vietnam War. It was at this rally that a call was made for another anti-war rally to be held on Monday, May 4th. Later on in the evening of May 1st, what started as the usual Friday night bar scene turned into a violent clash between protesters and police in downtown Kent. There is a lot of debate about what was truly the catalyst for the violence, but we do know that, quote, bonfires were built in the streets of downtown Kent, cars were stopped, police cars were hit with bottles, and some store windows were broken, end quote. And that is from Kent State's article, The May 4th Shootings at Kent State University, The Search for Historical Accuracy. I also want to add that the majority of my information will be coming from this source because they do correct inaccuracies that have been published by other authors. And toward the end of the episode, I will go over those inaccuracies and their corrections. From this point on, unless I state otherwise, all of my quotes will be from the Kent State article.
Okay, cool.
The entirety of the Kent police force and officers from the county were called in to disperse the crowd and eventually succeeded in that effort by using tear gas on the crowd. Sounds familiar, right?
Super great idea.
Love that. Love that in downtown. The next day, May 2nd, the mayor of Kent, Leroy Satram, met with city officials and a rep from the Ohio National Guard and made the decision to ask Ohio Governor James Allen Rhodes to send the Ohio National Guard to Kent. The mayor was apparently fearful of, quote, rumors that radical revolutionaries were in Kent to destroy the city and the university, end quote.
Okay. Radical revolutionaries. Okay.
It's just such a generalization, like fear-mongering of people who are just trying to use their rights.
Their literal right to protest. Okay.
Like I don't even need to like fancy it up, like their rights.
On May 2nd, around 10 p.m., the Ohio National Guard arrived in Kent. They came upon the scene of the wooden ROTC building across from the Commons set ablaze. That building would eventually burn to the ground as the evening went on. Quote, well over 1,000 demonstrators surrounded the building. Controversy continues to exist regarding who was responsible for setting fire to the ROTC building. But radical protesters were assumed to be responsible because of their actions in interfering with the efforts of firemen to extinguish the fire as well as cheering the burning of the building. Confrontations between guardsmen and demonstrators continued into the night, with tear gas filling the campus and numerous arrests being made. End quote.
Jesus.
On May 3rd, around 1,000 guardsmen occupied the Kent State campus, and Governor Rhodes flew to Kent. Quote, at a press conference, he issued a provocative statement calling campus protesters the worst type of people in America and stating that every force of law would be used to deal with them. Rhodes also indicated that he would seek a court order declaring a state of emergency, end quote. Before I continue on with like what I actually have here written in my notes, I just want to address the way that he said every force of law, because when you're speaking on that, you're speaking on every weapon that they have at their disposal. Mm-hmm. That's what I think of, especially when you're calling people the worst type of people in America for exercising their right to protest, because that in general, the protests were peaceful besides the burning down of the ROTC building. And we're not entirely sure what was the actual catalyst for the disruptions downtown on Friday night. So we can't actually say that it was the protesters who began violence.
Yeah.
So I just find it interesting with where this story goes, and I don't want to necessarily give it away yet, but I'm sure some people do know where this story goes with the fact that he said that.
Also, like, these are kids.
Yeah.
Just a reminder.
Literal college students.
Well, and I feel like we say students or like college students, you know, to age them up even, like, they're kids.
Right. 18, 19, 20, 21. Like,
and that doesn't lessen their belief at all. But it definitely should change the way that we like look at how they're handling this situation and how we respond to them.
Yes.
Someone has to be the grown up here.
So accurate for this situation and for what's happening today. So that court order that he was talking about getting to declare a state of emergency, that never actually happened. There was a widely held assumption, though, amongst the guard and university officials that there was a state of martial law. But going into this and everything that I'm about to tell you about the events that happened, just remember that he never actually got that court order to declare a state of emergency.
Which really, like, I think before COVID, people didn't really understand, like, what that meant in terms of how the law changes. Like, I don't think they understood sort of, like, the gravity of, like, what that would allow, like you said, martial law to come into play.
Mm-hmm.
I think that now that some states have experienced it, but, like, declaring that state of emergency gives the police so much power.
So much. And this meant that everyone was just assuming that the college was under control of the guard rather than the university itself and the leaders of the university, which then led to all further rallies being banned. And even with this belief of martial law, students continued to protest and were subjected to tear gas and arrests from guardsmen. On the morning of Monday, May 4th, university officials attempted to stop the rally that was called for on Friday, but a crowd began to form in the commons area around 11 a.m., an hour later, by noon, there was approximately 3,000 people in the commons. The next set of numbers that I'm about to list off, very much estimates. Around 500 people were gathered around the Victory Bell, and this was the core group of protesters. Another 1,000 were onlookers supporting the active demonstrators, and another 1,500 were honestly just spectators kind of like at the perimeter of the commons.
Okay.
Across from the commons at the burned down ROTC building, there were around 100 Ohio National Guardsmen, and they were equipped, Katie, with M1 Garand military rifles. I will definitely post photos of this. There's enough photos and video from that day where I can literally show you what they had actually that day in their hands. But I do want to point out that this type of rifle that they had there that day has a bayonet attached to the end of it. And that's just like insane when you're confronting college students. I have no words for how like absolutely unnecessary that is.
Like a full metal thing?
Yeah. Like a fucking knife at the end of the gun.
I could understand something, like an extended police baton, you know, just to kind of try and keep some space. Maybe a lawyer could argue that. But a full fucking bayonet, like just a knife, that's wild.
Yeah. And I do want to point out that, like, I looked up pictures of this when, like, I Googled it. I was like, M1 Garand, because I had already seen pictures and video of it from that day, but I wanted to see if there were versions of it without the bayonet, and there are.
So it was like a full choice.
Yeah, that's a whole choice. It's a whole ass decision that they made.
It's wild.
There is conflicting evidence about who was actually responsible for banning the rally on May 4th. Quote, at the 1975 federal civil trial, General Robert Canterbury, the highest official of the Guard, testified that widespread consensus existed that the rally should be prohibited because of the tensions that existed and the possibility that violence would occur again. Canterbury further testified that Kent State President Robert White had explicitly told Canterbury that any demonstration would be highly dangerous. In contrast, White testified that he could recall no conversation with Canterbury regarding the banning of the rally. The decision to ban the rally can most accurately be traced to Governor Rhodes' statements on Sunday, May 3rd, when he stated that he would be seeking a state of emergency declaration from the courts. Although he never did this, all officials, Guard, University, Kent, assumed that the Guard was now in charge of the campus and that all rallies were illegal. Thus, university leaders printed and distributed on Monday morning leaflets indicating that all rallies, including the May 4th rally scheduled for noon, were prohibited as long as the Guard was in control of the campus, end quote.
Huh.
Once again, he never actually got that court order for a state of emergency. So the pretense is not even there for them to be prohibiting a rally.
Yeah.
Initially, the rally was peaceful, as, let's be honest, most historically are, until the police or National Guard are called in. Shortly before noon, General Canterbury ordered the demonstrators to disperse from the commons, and a Kent State police officer made the announcement using a bullhorn. I have links to YouTube videos of newscasts from back in the day, from like CBS Evening News and things like that, where you do actually get to see that happening.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Cool.
The students did not listen to this order, so the officer was driven around the commons in a Jeep with guardsmen telling the students the rally was banned and they must leave. They were met with shouting and rocks being thrown at them, which caused the Jeep to retreat. I want to clarify the amount of people that were actually throwing rocks at the guardsmen. In an interview with CBS News from his hospital bed, a victim of the day's events, John Cleary, stated, quote, "A few kids were throwing sticks and stones, but that was only a handful, no more than 10 or 15, and then the guard shot tear gas up on the hill to disperse the crowd. The kids picked it up and threw it back," end quote. So out of a crowd of 3,000, it was like 10 to 15 people throwing rocks at the Jeep. The next things that happen are so fucking dramatic when you think about that.
Just like a wild escalation. Especially when you think about how if people were aware that there were just like 10 or 15 people throwing rocks, had a couple officers come in and were like, hey, we're arresting just these people, or like these people who are throwing rocks, like you guys need to leave. Everyone else can do their thing, but like you guys have to go. So much could have been avoided.
Oh yeah. General Canterbury ordered his men to load their weapons, and tear gas canisters were thrown into the crowd by the victory bell, and the guard began marching across the commons. The protesters were forced to move up Blanket Hill and then down the other side of it into the Prentice Hall parking lot and onto the practice football field. This is when the guardsmen realized that they were kind of trapped with the protesters because of the fence surrounding the field. The guardsmen remained on the field for about 10 minutes, all while being yelled at and having rocks thrown at them. There was a group of them that like huddled together, and some knelt and like pointed their guns at students, but no one had fired any shots. Keep that like huddling in mind, because it is a catalyst for rumors that the guardsmen devised a plan to shoot at the students. After this, the guardsmen trekked back up Blanket Hill, and when they got to the top, around 28 of the 70 guardsmen that were there at the top suddenly turned and fired their rifles and pistols. A lot of them were pointed at the ground. However, some of the guardsmen chose to fire directly into the crowd of students. It is estimated that between 61 and 67 shots were fired in a 13-second period.
Oh my god. What the fuck?
61 to 67 shots in 13 seconds.
That's really upsetting.
This led to 13 people being shot, with 4 of those being murdered. That's what it is. It's murder. Mm-hmm. Quote, "The closest student was Jeffrey Miller, who was shot in the mouth while standing in an access road leading into the Prentice Hall parking lot, a distance of approximately 270 feet from the guard. Allison Krause was in the Prentice Hall parking lot. She was 330 feet. from the guardsman and was shot in the left side of her body. William Schroeder was 390 from the guard in the Prentice Hall parking lot when he was shot in the left side of his back. Sandra Schuer, who was also about 390 feet from the guard in the Prentice Hall parking lot, was shot with a bullet that pierced the left front side of her neck," end quote. It should be noted that Jeffrey and Allison were actively participating in the protest, while William and Sandra were just bystanders. Not that any of them should have been shot, but some of these people who were killed and injured were literally just there. They were not even participating in the protest.
Like, this is a college campus where people are just like going about their fucking business because they have shit going on. And people frequently just like kind of like stop and hang out.
Yeah.
Especially if something like this is going on. Are you fucking kidding? Like, Jesus Christ.
I also do like that we are getting the distance that they are from the guardsmen, because at least to me, in my opinion, 390 feet away is showing me that you were, especially down a hill, you were not an immediate threat to the guardsmen.
Right?
But that's just me, I guess, as you'll learn later. The 9 students who were injured were Joseph Lewis. He was the closest to the guard at a distance of about 60 feet. Still, closest to the guard who was injured, still 60 feet away. He was shot in the abdomen and lower leg while standing still with his middle finger up at the guardsman. I love that energy so much.
Truly.
Thomas Grace was about the same distance and was shot in the left ankle. John Cleary was 100 feet away when he was shot in the upper left chest. Alan Canfora was 225 feet away and was shot in the wrist. Douglas Rentmore was shot in the right knee from 330 feet away. James Russell was shot in the right thigh and right forehead from 375 feet away. Robert Stamps was shot in the right butt cheek from 500 feet away. Donald McKenzie was the furthest from the guardsman at a distance of 750 feet, and he was shot in the neck. Lastly, Dean Collar was the most seriously wounded out of the 9 wounded students, and he was shot in the back from about 300 feet away and was permanently paralyzed from the waist down.
Jesus Christ.
The scene on campus in the immediate aftermath of the 13-second barrage of bullets was chaos. The guardsmen retreated to the commons, only to come upon a large and justifiably, in my mind, angry crowd that greatly outnumbered them. It goes without saying that with the full knowledge of there being live ammunition, this situation absolutely could have become worse and much more deadly. Thanks to the quick thinking of several Kent State University staff members, the violence was quelled by pleading, the staff is pleading with the guardsmen to allow them to speak to the students. And they begged the students not to confront the guardsmen more. It took around 20 minutes of like highly emotional pleading for the students to disperse from the commons. And I can only imagine like these teachers have created bonds and relationships with these students, and they just saw 13 of them be mowed down, 4 dead, and they're just like please, we don't want to lose any more of you.
Yeah, I'm like Facebook friends with many of my college professors. Like my 21st birthday was spent out with one of my professors who was he's probably 55 years old Scottish gay man who was just wonderful. Your professors are like part of who you become. I can't even imagine.
There is a very famous photo from that day of Marianne Vecchio, a runaway who was 14 years old at the time, kneeling and screaming over the body of Jeffrey Miller. This photo was taken by student John Philo. It was published on the front pages of newspapers and magazines countrywide. He went on to win a Pulitzer Prize for this photo. John said that when the shooting happened, he actually didn't take cover because he initially thought that the bullets being fired were blanks. Because, like, of course, like, who the fuck would shoot at students? Yeah. Who the fuck would shoot at students? But he noticed that the bullets were hitting the ground. Blanks don't hit the ground.
Oh, that's really interesting.
The university was then ordered to be closed by President Robert White. Following that decision, Portage County Prosecutor Ronald Kane filed an injunction to indefinitely close the university from Common Pleas Judge Albert Karras. Faculty and staff actually worked on like activities and classes and things through the mail, through off-campus meetings at like churches and meeting spaces and things like that to try to allow the students to finish their semester. The university was not opened for another 6 weeks until the summer of 1970.
Wow.
In the days and weeks following this massacre, even more anti-war student protests took place across the country. And on May 9th, around 100,000 demonstrators protested in front of the White House. And shortly after the Kent State massacre, another shooting occurred on a college campus. At Jackson State University in Mississippi on May 15th, city and state police opened fire on a group of students, killing 2 and injuring 12.
Jesus.
Because once it happens, they're like, oh, it's cool for us to do this? Okay.
Once precedent is set.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, the biggest question related to the shooting is, why did the guardsmen shoot? Who gave them orders to do so? Or more accurately, did anyone actually give them orders to do so? In order to answer this question and not mince my words and things that took place around the legal cases, I'm going to read directly from that Kent State article. Quote, two quite different answers have been advanced to this question. One, the guardsmen fired in self-defense and the shootings were therefore justified. And two, the guardsmen were not in immediate danger and therefore the the shootings were unjustified. The answer offered by the guardsmen is that they fired because they were in fear of their lives. Guardsmen testified before numerous investigating commissions, as well as in federal court, that they felt the demonstrators were advancing on them in such a way as to pose a serious and immediate threat to the safety of the guardsmen, and they therefore had to fire in self-defense. Some authors, for example, Meichner in 1971 and Grant and Hill in 1974, agree with this assessment. Much more importantly, federal criminal and civil trials have accepted the position of the guardsmen. In a 1974 federal criminal trial, District Judge Frank Battisti dismissed the case against 8 guardsmen indicted by a federal grand jury, ruling at mid-trial, literally middle of the trial, that the government's case against the guardsmen was so weak that the defense did not have to present its case. In the much longer and more complex federal civil trial of 1975, a jury voted 9-3 that none of the guardsmen were legally responsible for the shootings. This decision was appealed, however, and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that a new trial had to be held because of the improper handling of a threat to a jury member. The legal aftermath of the May 4th shootings ended in January of 1979, 9 years later, with an out-of-court settlement involving a statement signed by 28 defendants, as well as a monetary settlement. And the guardsmen and their supporters view this as a final vindication of their position. The financial settlement provided $675,000 to the wounded students and the parents of the students who had been killed. This money was paid by the state of Ohio rather than by any guardsmen, and the amount equaled what the state estimated it would cost to go to trial again. Perhaps most importantly, the statement signed by members of the Ohio National Guard was viewed by them to be a declaration of regret, not an apology or an admission of wrongdoing. And then there is a little caveat here from Kent State, where they say, in retrospect, the tragedy of May 4th, 1970 should not have occurred. The students may have believed that they were right in continuing their mass protest in response to the Cambodian invasion, which I still think that they are because he never got that fucking injunction for the state of emergency. So like the basis of all of this is bullshit, but okay. Whew. Even though this protest followed the posting and reading by the university of an order to ban rallies and an order to disperse. These orders have since been determined by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals to have been lawful, which still blows my mind because we were not in a state of emergency, but okay. Some of the guardsmen on Blanket Hill, fearful and anxious from prior events, may have believed in their own minds that their lives were in danger. Hindsight suggests that another method would have resolved the confrontation. Better ways must be found to deal with such a confrontation. We devoutly wish that a means had been found to avoid the May 4th events culminating in the guard shootings and the irreversible deaths and injuries. We deeply regret those events and are profoundly saddened by the deaths of 4 students and the wounding of 9 others which resulted. We hope that the agreement to end the litigation will help to assuage the tragic memories regarding that sad day. And that's their little caveat. And now we go back into the information about answering these questions of like who the fuck is responsible. A starkly different interpretation of that of the guards has been offered in numerous other studies of the shootings, with all of these analyses sharing the common viewpoint that primary responsibility for the shootings lies with the guardsmen. Some authors, for example, Stone, 1971, Davies, 1973, and Kellner and Munvis in 1980, argue that the guardsmen's lives were not in danger. Instead, these authors argue that the evidence shows that certain members of the guard conspired on the practice football field to fire when they reached the top of Blanket Hill. Other authors, Best in 1981 and Payne in 1981, do not find sufficient evidence to accept the conspiracy theory, but also they don't find the guard self-defense theory to be plausible. Experts who find the guard primarily responsible find themselves in agreement with the conclusion of the Scranton Commission. Quote, the indiscriminate firing of rifles into a crowd of students and the deaths that followed were unnecessary, unwarranted, and inexcusable. End quote. It's wild to see the very two contrasting opinions here on the responsibility of this shooting. Like, I genuinely just want to know, like, did someone tell them fire? Or did this small group be like, yo, when we get to the top of this shit, we're just going to fire at them because this shit is crazy. Like, how are we here right now? In their article, Kent State provides 6 unanswered questions surrounding the events of the massacre. 1, who was responsible for the violence in downtown Kent and on the Kent State campus in the 3 days prior to May 4th? As an important part of this question, were quote-unquote outside agitators primarily responsible? Who was responsible for setting fire to the ROTC building? 2, should the guard have been called to Kent and Kent State University? Could local law enforcement personnel have handled any situations? Were the guard properly trained for this type of assignment? 3, did the Kent State University administration respond appropriately in their reactions to the demonstrations and with Ohio political officials and guard officials? 4, would the shootings have been avoided if the rally had not been banned? Did the banning of the rally violate First Amendment rights? 5, did the guardsmen conspire to shoot students when they huddled on the practice football field? If not, why did they fire? Were they justified in firing? 6, who was ultimately responsible for the events of May 4th, 1970? It's wild to think about these questions that have gone unanswered, because I think that those unanswered questions are a big part of why this is not talked about enough, because there are so many loose ends and no one knows where responsibility for certain things lies. How are you able to tell a complete story of the events that happened when there's still so many pretty deep fucking questions on people's responsibility and their actions during that entire weekend?
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I think a little bit, a lot of it, this isn't talked about because no one wants to sit down and have a discussion about how Kent State and the police department and National Guard murdered children.
Yeah.
Because the responsibility lies with the trained professionals who are supposed to deal with this properly.
I do think another, and this is something that I actually saw somebody bring up in a comment section, where they referred to this as a school shooting. And I was like, in this context, I do believe that this absolutely qualifies as a quote unquote school shooting. I know that we're used to it being like maybe a student or a disgruntled staff member or something like that. But this was a, in my book, unjustified shooting and murder of students on their campus. It doesn't matter who it was by. This is a school shooting. And I think that no matter how many times it happens in this country, there are still so many people, especially the news and officials, government officials, who are very uncomfortable with discussing school shootings, especially when they fail most of the time to keep any of us safe when school shootings happen. And this time, it was on their fucking hands.
Exactly. That is why I personally think that it's not talked about, because the cops have no problems talking about other open cases where they may look a lot better that have the same questions.
I want to go over those historical inaccuracies real quick that they addressed in the Kent State article. Quote, despite the substantial literature which exists on the Kent State shootings, misinformation and misunderstanding continue to surround the events of May 4th. For example, a prominent college-level United States history book by Mary Beth Norton that was published in 1994, which is also used in high school AP courses, contains a picture of the shootings of May 4th accompanied by the following summary of events. Quote, in May 1970 at Kent State University in Ohio, National Guardsmen confronted student anti-war protesters with a tear gas barrage. Soon afterward, with no provocation, soldiers opened fire into a group of fleeing students. 4 young people were killed, shot in the back, including 2 women who had been walking to class. End quote. Unfortunately, this short description contains 4 factual errors. 1, some degree of provocation did exist. 2, the students were not fleeing when the guard initially opened fire. They had all been kettled into those areas.
Yeah.
3, only one of the 4 students who died, William Schroeder, was shot in the back. And 4, one female student, Sandy Schuer, had been walking to class, but the other female, Allison Krause, had been a part of the demonstration, end quote. So that's an example of some of the narrative that literally your history book that's being taught in college and high school AP classes gets wrong about these events.
Yes.
And then we have an anti-war song that was inspired by the events of May 4th, written by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, entitled Ohio. I'm going to read the lyrics to you guys, but highly suggest you go listen to the song because it's certainly a vibe. I don't really know how else to put that. Tin soldiers and Nixon coming, we're finally on our own. This summer, I hear the drumming, 4 dead in Ohio. Gotta get down to it, soldiers are cutting us down. Should have been gone long ago. What if you knew her and found her dead on the ground? How can you run when you know? Tin soldiers and Nixon coming, we're finally on our own. This summer, I hear the drumming, 4 dead in Ohio. 4, I said 4. How many more? Why? I want to know why. You better tell me why. Why did they die? I was listening to this song within the days of like Macklemore posting about Hens Hall. And it's just fucking crazy to see history literally repeating itself as far as the artists who are standing up, creating things like this, really poignant lyrics, calling out our leadership for their bullshit. And then just seeing the student protests happening again and the insane escalation. Because when you look at the actual encampments and the student protests that we're seeing now, it is always peaceful. And they're doing like teach-ins on the lawns. They're cooking for each other. Like, it is very much a celebration of Palestinian people and wanting to make sure that their culture is taught about and talked about and calling out the universities for their complicity in this genocide. And then the violence occurs when police and counter-protesters show up. That's when the violence happens. But that's the only thing being shown on the news.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty par for the course. I mean, I remember quite a few of the BLM protests that I went to, that was exactly the case.
Yeah. Dude, you had a sniper up on the roof of the buildings that you sent me a video of in Portland, Maine.
Yeah, it was wild. And to just like see how quickly history is repeating itself, I think that that's what's really blowing my mind personally. History repeats itself. That's what we always talk about. But it usually takes a little bit longer, I think, for the cycles, I think, to repeat.
Mm-hmm. It feels like they're very much speeding up.
It really does.
I also do want to mention that when this shooting happened, a majority of the reaction to the protests and the student protests and just everything was fuck the students, which is kind of wild because we're once again seeing that happen, that like public opinion is really giving the narrative of like, fuck these students. My dad had on, I don't know, I think it was like Fox or something the other day, and I walked in from work and I heard this, they were talking about the student protests, and this is what I heard come out of this one man's mouth. The Arab summer needs to end. Talking about the students protesting, and I literally just went, oh, that's racist. And then my dad muted it. And I was like, bro, I love him so much. You know, he's not a bad person, but he is way too sucked into fucking Fox News. And I for years have been trying to pull him away from that. Now I'm just going to take the Roku and I'm going to turn it off and not sign him back into that fucking app because I can't anymore. I was like, that's insane that I came home from work and that's what you're consuming.
Yes. Literally so wild. And for anyone who's listening, CNN's not better.
Oh, no. Oh, my God. No. I only mentioned that one because I physically walked into the room to that.
Oh, absolutely.
None of them are better.
I just needed to throw it out there because far too often people are like, Fox News. And then they turn around and turn on CNN. And I'm like,
you're like, so much worse.
Corporate same is thing. Asking you to find the difference between these photos. They're the same one.
The Venn diagram is a circle.
Just needed to throw that out there. because it is important to note.
Stand up for the students. Stand up for Gaza. Stand up for the Palestinian people. It's actually fucking insane that this is repeating over and over and over again. Like, have we literally learned nothing? The students are always on the right side of history. Always.
Completely agree. I just, like, can't believe that we're still having to, like, try and justify and explain.
Like, why we shouldn't be literally killing people?
Yeah, like, yes, the students are on the right side of history, of course. But also, there's, like, literally a genocide. How is this a conversation?
We literally had a whole episode about crimes against humanity. Like, we know what levels we're at with these things. This is a genocide.
This is a full-blown fucking genocide.
This is a full-blown ethnic cleansing and land grab of a people's whole fucking nation that's been happening for decades.
I'm running out of ways to, like, patiently explain children are dying.
Like, children are dying, please care. Even if they don't look like you and they're not from your country, please give a shit. I'm not even entirely sure how to end this because we are at the end of my notes. Just really not sure how to close this out.
I guess my opinion on how to close this out would be, I know that there are no Zionists listening to this podcast still. I know that you have not made it to this point. But if you are a person who has someone who is in that field, you can try and educate them. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. There is no shame in just hitting the mute button mm-hmm. for a little bit. You don't owe anything to anyone. And that includes, like, your presence in their life. So if you are giving a lot of your energy and your effort into, like, trying to convince this person to, like, see your side, and it's just draining you, it's okay to stop and redirect that energy into something else that is also fueling education or whatever source of, like, community aid. There are just some people who aren't going to listen, and I know how badly we want to, like, make them, but we cannot keep screaming into the void.
You literally said this to me the day after I moved as I was trying to set up my bedroom at your house because I had someone yell at me in my DMs, somebody that we know from high school times, on a video of peaceful protesters who were arrested being released and people were cheering for them, and screamed at me for something that was, like, not even entirely related at all. And I was like, what do I do? I'm literally sobbing because I just left the place that I had called home for 8 years. I can't emotionally handle a conversation with this person. You were like, you already know that this person is not coming to you in good faith for an actual conversation. Just don't even respond. And I didn't.
You don't have to engage. And that's not copping out because they're not engaging you in good faith.
Yeah.
So direct your efforts where you think that they're going to go the best. And it's not giving up to redirect.
Thank you for that, Katie. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, y'all. This is the end of the road for my episode. We love you all very much. Try to keep it sane. Try to keep yourself sane and lean on each other and community support. And we're here. We're here if you need us. Okay. Love you.
I was going to say, keep it 100. What the fuck?
I don't know. I don't even know. Sometimes I just push it out of my ass when we're ending.
That's what I was going to say. Keep it 100. What, I've never said that in my entire life. Bye, guys.
Bye.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it, too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cashback and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cashback sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cashback. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
For any photos related to today's episode, please go to our Instagram.
You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at AL2KPodcast.
Like us on Facebook at Always the Last to Know Podcast.
If you have any questions, please email us at AL2KPodcast. kpodcast@gmail.com.
Please share, rate, and review us on your podcast listening app of choice.
Join our Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/AL2KPodcast or click the link in our bio on social media.
Thanks for listening.